The count is 2-2. The pitch is on the way, and Freeman swings and pokes it into right. That's a base hit. The game is tied as Berger scores. Stopping at second is Higashioka, and it is 5-5 in the ninth.
You're an idiot, and you don't know baseball.
Ranger fans, you're not dreaming.
How can you not be romantic about baseball?
Ranger fans, you were not dreaming about that finish last night. 7-5. Wow. Come from behind win. Down two in the night. Final strike. Down to their final strike. And they wind up tying the game and then winning the game in extra innings. You may have won the battle and lost the war. We'll see what happens with the Dolis in terms of the quad.
That's not losing a war.
Well, maybe not. Although, you know, he is...
not saying it's nothing. It's not, yeah. Losing a war. Seager's a war.
Seager's a war, for sure. But
literally, W-A-R.
Literally. But, you know, you get to... Maybe you do find a way to scratch claw the playoffs, and then, you know, Dolis was the ALCS MVP.
Hey, they're doing better with the more guys they're losing, so keep dropping like flies.
Keep dropping like flies. Doesn't matter, except for DeGrom. We need him.
Yeah.
And Jack Leiter. And Jack Leiter, who has been fantastic. We'll give him his flowers in a second. But... Diamond Cavs here. Rangers do get the 7-5 victory,
man,
in Arizona in a game that, you know,
One of those games.
They were down the whole time.
You somehow make it. You're like, this one of those five,
mm-hmm,
that I think you remember.
Yeah.
5-3, and then Osuna, Berger triple, Adolis limping around, the Zeke slide, Cody Freeman as well, Armstrong all of a sudden.
Yeah, absolutely. The slides there, obviously, but... You're down 3-0 real quick, you know, second inning, and 3 home runs, 3 solo shots. First, back-to-back pitches in the first inning to Marte and Perdomo.
I have no idea. I was watching Belichick get off to an amazing start.
Yeah, I mean, it was quick. It was quick off Corbin to give those 2 home runs. Marte lead up the game in the very next pitch. I think it was Perdomo that hit one. But, yeah, there you go. And then you find yourself down in a 3-0 hole. And you scratch and claw, and you tie it in the sixth, and then you allow 2 more runs, and now you get down to the ninth inning, and Adolis is on first, and he's got a hobbled quad now, and Berger goes up in a pinch hit situation, dead red.
Just say that out loud. A limping, because he's always got some type of strain, a compromised Adolis Garcia is going to score from first on the next pitch on... A triple burger. Jake Berger's going to hit a triple, and Adolis will actually score the way he's running like Giancarlo Stanton.
Right. Exactly. I think he would have beat Stanton in a foot race, even still. But, I mean, you don't expect that. You don't expect Berger to go up there and lace a triple into the gap. I mean, he's a home run or nothing kind of guy. And you don't expect him to get a triple, let alone that. You know, even leg one out. But, you know, they do. And then, was it Freeman? I think it was Freeman that got the hit the very next at-bat. Or a little bit later on in that inning to tie the game. So, you get the tie game. You go to extras. You wind up winning it in extra innings. Martin did a great job in his first time back. Then Armstrong, like you mentioned. The bullpen overall. I mean, there was an inherited run that was allowed to score. But, you know, that was not an earned run.
1.5 back in the wild card. And then you just recap the rest of the weekend. Sunday, Jock homered, doubled, drove in 3. DeGrom struck out 6 and 5 scoreless. Continues to absolutely own the Athletics, and they pull off the sweep. DeGrom, 2 hits, walked 1. Rangers, that was their 5th straight win. He had been 0-4 in his last 5 starts. All Ranger losses, and his previous win was July 22nd. First start after the break. Snap that. Saturday, Josh Young... had tied a baseball high this year with 3 straight games of 3 hits. He had 3 hits Saturday. Merrill Kelly, Bobby's guy, pitching into the 7th. They win 9-3. Wyatt and Moore, they homered. Higgy, 2 RBI singles. And then Adolis had 3 of the 17 hits. Every Ranger batter got at least 1 on Saturday. And then Friday, Jack Leiter,
and this is the thing, you know, he might really be the key to this playoff run. He's been very good of late. 2.88 ERA over his last 11 starts. And then Friday.
11?
Yeah, last 11 starts, 2.88 ERA. Friday in Oakland, really good. In his last 13 innings, he's allowed 2 runs. He struck out 17, and more importantly, he's walked just 2. in those 13 innings in those last two games. And let me tell you something. That is not the, those are not the numbers over 11 starts of a number three or a number four. That's a one or a two. A 2.88 earned run average over 11 starts is the numbers that you expect from a one or a two. That's a top of the rotation guy. And this for him to be there, that's exactly why you picked him at that spot. Right, General?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Now, if they, I know you just said if they make the playoffs or whatever else, it might
he's
be
key.
Because
he's a massive key.
He's
to that
a key.
Yeah.
To me, the biggest thing is, and we just referenced them twice, if they make the playoffs, it's going to be because Wyatt Langford and Josh Young keep hitting. Because that's been the biggest problem all season, is that when they haven't had offense, it hasn't mattered how dominant the pitching's been. They've been a 500 team. And so if you're looking at this team making the postseason, especially with Seager out right now and Carter out and all the different injuries that they've had, it's going to have to be those two. And they've been great over the last 33 games for both of them. Over the last 33 games, Josh Young's hitting .313. Over the last 33 games for Wyatt Langford, he's hitting .305. His OPS is .966. That's like the heart of your lineup right now. That's the meat of what you're getting. And they've got to continue to be those guys all the way through the end of the year.
And then you sit there and you look at what Jack did. Struck out 7 in 6 innings. 2 runs on 5 hits. Paulie Milner retired all 4 batters he faced. Armstrong got the final 5 outs for his 5th save on Friday. And the Rangers are rolling.
Yeah, they are. They have clawed their way right back into everything. They're still 4.5 back in the West. But winners of 9 of 10 now, and they're 5 back in the loss column of Houston. The good news is you got 6 games of Houston left. I mean, you can make up every single one of those games. You are within the games left that you have of the Astros. That's key. You're also got a fallback, which is the wild card, a game and a half back of Seattle. You know, you're still, what, 5 back of Boston and New York in that wild card for the top spots, but you don't need the top spot. You just need one of them. So if, you know, obviously if they get into that 6th spot, they would have to face what the 4 seed, which would be the worst of the division winners. So there's benefit to that. There's benefit to that. I guess it'd be the 3 seed, but worst of the division winners. The rest of the divisions have kind of, you know, tightened up a little bit. Toronto had a 6 game lead. Now it's at a 2.5 for both Boston and New York. Detroit's running away with the Central. Houston up 3 on Seattle, 4.5 on us. In the National League, though, Padres and Dodgers, that's going to come right down to the wire. 2.5 games separate those two. This is only a Major League Baseball problem. Labor Day weekend. There are 3 holiday weekends across the sport. By the way, there were only 13 games in the schedule yesterday. There should have been 15. Every single team needs to play on Labor Day. Every single team needs to play on Labor Day, 4th of July, and Memorial Day.
Please play earlier. That's
the way baseball goes.
And play earlier.
Day games. The 2 games, Peyton texted us.
Yep.
2 games I was looking forward to did not start till 7 p.m. The North Carolina TCU and then Rangers starting later.
So, but there was a problem across the sport over the weekend. The MLB Ballpark app. Now, we all have it. You've got to have it in order to get into the game. Okay, the Ballpark app. It crashed. Labor Day, one of the 3 weekends of the year that cannot crash. Memorial Day, Labor Day, 4th of July.
I have been stunned that an old sport forces this type of technology in order to attend a game. Stunning.
Yeah. Now, look.
And I haven't heard people really complain about it.
It's easy. It's generally pretty easy.
Yeah.
But technology is great
until it's not.
That's the problem with technology. It makes our lives so much easier. But the moment it happens where something crashes, we act like we didn't ever know what a paper ticket was.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, it doesn't crash. It's paper. Paper doesn't crash.
Paper doesn't crash. So what these fans had to do is, you know, we're talking about thousands of fans outside the stadiums trying to get into these games, going to the ticket counter, and having to get paper tickets printed for them. Just brutal. Just brutal. But only Major League Baseball. Only Major League Baseball would have this happen. Thankfully, it doesn't happen that often. It's generally a pretty good system. Diamond Cavs here on 105 through the Fan. I saw one of the more crazy stats over the weekend. Aaron Judge hit his 358th home run, and that's all with the Yankees. So that put him in the top 5 of team home runs all time. That top 5 had been unchanged since 1957.
Wow.
75 years. That is one, I couldn't believe it. Like, in the era of the home run, to have it unchanged, the top five of a team home run record list to be unchanged in 75 years is wild to me. I don't know if that says more about how good those five were or how bad that team has been since then, but it makes no sense that you would have something like that happen. But there's Diamond Cavs here on the fan.
I'm texting with Don Van Natta.
Well.
Jeremy Fowler can join us at 8:40 this morning.
I believe we have a segment spoken for.
Yeah, you gotta check with me.
We have the ball knowers of ball.
Well, you definitely just got it canceled.
There we go.
What?
Well, by naming it.
See, that's why I did it like that.
Diamond Cavs with Ralph James Choppy. We are your home for Rangers baseball on DFW Sports Station. The article that we're referencing, Don Van Natta, on what really happened inside the mic idea. Jeremy Fowler was one talking about the other teams that were involved as well. So far, what I've gotten from it, I'm about three quarters of the way through. That big Mike and Jerry meeting was 3 hours. The guarantee offer from the Cowboys was north of 150. Again, this is all from the Cowboys side. Micah called Steven back after the Jerry meeting to up the terms. They agreed to up the terms. And then when Micah didn't agree, that was the end. This is old school mano a mano. I looked you in the eye, shook your hand, and you broke it, and I cannot trust you. That, to me, is what caused this whole thing to disintegrate. Micah's agency says they never saw an offer, ever. They never saw an offer on paper, and Mulligetta, from that point forward, never had a negotiation with Jerry. That's crazy. That is crazy. Jerry was just like, no, this is it. I'm holding you to it.
I don't think the Cowboys would dispute that either, though. The part about not giving, like, that their side never saw anything in writing. I don't think they sent that.
We were told in Oxnard that Micah and his agent wanted to go last. That's in this piece. He thought because he was 3 and 5 years younger than TJ and Miles Garrett, he would blow past their deals. But I thought so far, the biggest quote in here was Micah not being able to play the run. That's the biggest thing in here. Mission critical. A Cowboys source was calling, stopping the run. Micah couldn't do it, and teams would just go ahead and run right at him. And then they were not concerned about fan reaction. That's something I wrote down.
Yeah, I'm not. Jerry, again, kind of, we didn't talk about it enough maybe at the time. That press conference the other day when they're talking about, you got Micah coming here in a month, what are you going to do? And Jerry goes, we need to get ahead so we can run the ball right at him. And, like, I mean, that's kind of reference to where they think he's weak and that they can take advantage of it. This is, I don't know. Normally when there's divorce like this, it puts things to bed. Right. I don't know that this is going to be put to bed right away. Like, I mean, they've played nice for the most part, but I think you're going to hear more kind of back and forth all the way leading up to and probably through that week four game.
Don't fake your own death. The broke boy of the year and our first college football meltdown. It's a Tuesday, 8:20. It's PP in the morning.
Hey!
With Peyton Russell. Then Jeremy Fowler, ESPN, Tommy Yarsh, and Kyle Brandt, NFL Network. Show of Wales continuing on The Fan.
Well, congrats to Peyton Manna. He has found himself on the most toxic show on The Fan, and there's no number two.
He put together the single worst 30 minutes in live radio history.
That is right, 8:20 on a Tuesday. After Labor Day weekend, it's time for a little PP in the morning. Every Tuesday at this very time. And we have a bunch of stories to get to, not a lot of time. And so we'll start off with some college football. You had week one, a lot of ups, a lot of downs. But are we witnessing the downfall of the Alabama Crimson Tide? Saturday's loss to Florida State had a lot of college football fans happy, including myself, because it took a lot of steam off the Texas loss. You know, you had a lot of people clown Alabama. Some people focus on Arch, but a lot of people went to Alabama after their loss to Florida State, including former LSU center Bobby Hebert, who is also a member of Barstool Sports. And we have our first meltdown of the year, Sean, in college football.
Bobby Hebert?
Bobby Hebert, yes.
Okay.
Former LSU center. He's now a current member of the Barstool Sports Club, or team there. And he let out an all-time rant here on one of his podcasts from over the weekend.
It's over, Alabama, you pieces of shit. You cocky f***ing penthouse living motherfuckers used to sit up there and used to piss on all of us. When you beat us, you would say, oh, well, you know, you should be happy. You put up a good fight. Blah, blah. You f***ing f***ers. Your time, now you're down here in the suck. How does it feel? And the best part is, I know it feels worse for you than it feels for us because you're not used to being here for 20 years. You have lived a charm existence where everything revolved around you. Everything you had, you got. Everything you wanted was at the tips of your fingers. You never had to worry about shit entering a single fucking weekend. And now, every fucking weekend, you're going to feel the existential threat of losing games that you didn't have to think twice about in the past. And so you have this standard that is so out of touch with reality. You're like a trust fund kid that is bankrupt, and that makes me happy. And again, I hope that I can f-ing bathe in your tears. I will cover myself in them. I will be consumed by them. I will drink them out and drink my own urine just to enjoy your pain again. So get ready, because guess what? You spend a lot of time at the top, but it ain't no fun when the rabbit's got the gun, is it, motherfucker? You, Alabama.
It's all, everything great. We've always thought great. About, and he finally said it. He put it all there in about 90 seconds. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
That is
job.
Fantastic.
That was an Ultimate Warrior promo.
It really was.
I was going to say, it sounded like almost like macho man. Like,
yeah.
Ooh.
Yes. And we'll find out if the FCC catches anything that Peyton missed on those.
Well, we'll find out at 10:01 in the Spittle meeting.
That was fantastic, though. And
yeah, the only question left in this is, are they willing to buy out DeBoer? Because this is done.
It's done.
This will be a new coach. This season will be done. And the only question is, what are they willing to pay and who's available?
I have no doubt that Kalen DeBoer is a really good football coach. And I also have no doubt that he is an awful fit at Alabama. You, it is just different there. Like, you have to be, I can't remember who said it. I said, in order to coach at the SEC, you got to be a borderline criminal. I said it over the weekend. You got to be a borderline criminal to be able to survive that, and you do. It's just a different animal, like especially the at Alabama with those expectations. It's not a slight on Kalen DeBoer. Sometimes it just doesn't work. You know, Shaka Smart's proven to be a good basketball coach. Worked at VCU, working at Marquette, did work here. It happens, right? It happens. Didn't work at Texas. DeBoer, bad fit. Bad fit.
They got
too nice of a guy.
They got Wisconsin at Georgia. They lost to my Commodores last year. At Missouri, Tennessee, South Carolina, both top 25 right now. This is it. Tennessee, in order. Tennessee, South Carolina, LSU, Oklahoma. Four straight.
And that could be the end of it.
Then Auburn to end the year.
And that could be the end. And Auburn's pretty good this year.
And that's at like, Auburn.
He is a youth pastor in a world of crooks. And he is just not gonna work there. And then also the reality is that I don't know what Alabama's money situation is like. We talked about this at the party the other day, Bobby. I have no, like, I don't know that Alabama has the same NIL money as, I know they don't have the same as Texas. I know they don't have the same as A&M, Georgia, Florida, Tennessee, maybe South Carolina. I don't know. Like, how many Fortune 500 companies are in Alabama?
I think DeBoer could have worked at Alabama. And I mean, obviously it's a little early, but I mean, I think DeBoer could have worked at Alabama, just not as the guy following Saban. Like, I don't know why anybody wanted that job. You have to follow Saban with a program that was clearly declining and adjusting to a new era of how they were going to have to recruit. Like, that was not going to be as good as Saban, and it was going to make you look like a fool no matter what you did because it was going to be under him. This is going to be one of these. He's going to have to rebound, take a smaller job, and rebuild his credibility. But that sucks for him because I think he's a good coach.
Yeah, Tolo Chris was the only one who understood my questioning of Bobby Hebert, the New Orleans Saints quarterback. So I guess there's another one. Payload.
Another guy.
Payload on Thursday, PP in the morning, right now.
Yeah, so it only took 1 week. And this would be so Alabama for them to just go on a run here, though. You know, shut everyone up. But yeah, I'm with everyone else. It's not going to happen. You're looking at 4 or 5 losses easily. But all right, yeah, as Sean said, PP in the morning every Tuesday at this time. We got an early nominee, maybe a later nominee, but for potential broke boy of the year. I understand money is always a sensitive subject, but you be the judge here. This guy here, he took a girl on a date. And after the date, he sent her a Venmo request for the extreme amount of $3.25. because that's how much her half of the fries were. They shared a platter there. She ate half the fries. He's like, you know what? You're going to owe me for this. Now, at the date, I will like to say this. She did offer to cover the tip of the total. So she did pay something. You know, there's always that big back and forth and debate of, you know, okay, does the guy always pay on the first date? The answer is yes. But yeah, so we have an early broke boy candidate here. And this thing just ended up going south. Obviously, there's no second date here after this, but she was very upset about, called him out on it. And I just want your thoughts on this. Does he have a right to, or is he the wrong here, I guess? Or you could call it, you know, a-hole here. Who's the a-hole?
The funny part about this is Peyton setting this up as like, the broke boy, when out of the four of us here, the one who would do this is that man right there behind the glass. He would absolutely send a Venmo request for half the fries.
No. I would just not order the queso at the beginning. I would set the standard straight then.
I don't believe this story.
I'm with you.
I don't believe anyone would do a Venmo request for half an order of French fries.
Unless
you wanted to go viral.
Yeah, or unless there was something about the date where you're like,
a fight.
Screw this B. I'm gonna be as petty as possible.
And the first date payment thing, there are a lot of women who split it and are, I think I've seen, say they're fine with splitting it. So I mean, I'm with you the way it should go and probably does go most of the time. But there's a lot of people who are like, no, I understand first date if you go ahead and split.
But see, I hate the whole requesting the Venmo or any money amount. Like, I'd rather just text you or be like, okay, like, this is a total. Everyone owes me, you know, $50 and go from there. If you're not sending me the Venmo, I have to somehow bring it up later on. I'm not the guy that's just going to be, here's a Venmo request, you know, to you.
I don't think I've ever done a request on a Venmo.
You want the Venmo? You don't want the Venmo request.
No, I don't think I have the guts to send it out and be like, you know, I'd rather just tell you, hey, you owe me this amount, and now it's up to you to honor the payment.
Like Carter Fremont, he should be sending all of us Venmo requests to pay into the fantasy league. I guarantee you, have you paid?
No. I guarantee, I don't even know what the buy-in is.
I guarantee you I'm the only one who has paid.
I've paid two.
Or one of three. But yeah. Carter should, to get all the money straight, he should send the Venmo request. But no, I don't send them either.
Yeah, I never have. I just don't know. But, you know, like the whole paying on the first... You're right. I mean, there are plenty who are cool with paying the first date or splitting or whatever. Or if you're going to two places. You know, you got your first place, one pays, the next place, the other. I mean, you know, right?
Alternate.
Like, right, alternate. It's just the Venmo request for $4. I'm not buying it.
And then how about the guts on this guy? Neither he told her she was overreacting, and that's all about just being fair. FAF, Sean, just got to be fair, man.
Where was this? Does it say city or state?
It does not say here, I don't believe.
Okay. $8 for a side of fries, by the way.
Thanks, Biden.
817, early broke boy of the year, it's September.
Yeah, I do it early there. I think man wordy, but...
Man, it is September.
We do have a nominee, though. There it is. Yeah, forget the early part, but that's right. It is peeping in the morning every Tuesday at this time. Now we get to the real story, faking your own death. Has anyone actually thought about faking their own death? Maybe the thought has crossed your mind, but actually committing to it.
Absolutely.
You have a whole plan planned out and everything?
No, I had nothing planned out, but I thought about it.
You thought about it.
Okay. Absolutely thought about it. Why are we thinking about it? When was this?
I've thought about this several times. Like, how would I do it? Like, how impossible it is to do right now. Like, it's much easier to do. Like, you could have done this, like, decades, even in the 80s. You get a fake road. Just move to the next town. Nobody will find you again.
There was a guy who tried this. I can't remember if we did the story on the air or not, but there was a guy who tried this in like Utah, and he had disappeared, and he got away with it for about 5 months before they found him in another country, and like they tracked down a wire transfer he had made or something. Yeah, it's pretty impossible now. That's the thing I probably think I could do with no experience. I could just like make myself disappear. That's my rational thing.
Back in the 50s, like all you had to do, like if you wanted to just leave your family, move 20 minutes away, they'll never find you again.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so much harder now.
Well, this man in Wisconsin, Ryan Borgwart, he was married and had three kids, successfully faked his own death so he could go cheat on his wife with a European girl he met online, but he was only successful for 89 days before he was finally caught. Ryan did the old kayaking death where, you know, you flip over the kayak, you say, oh, I drowned, you know, you discard your he discarded his phone, his wallet, keys, all that stuff, but no one could find the body. And then he was able to swim to shore and he got out of it or got away, made his way to a different country. But after nearly 2 months, no one could find his body. He had purchased a new passport, bought nearly $400,000 life insurance policy, and he reversed a vasectomy. but he never changed his name. Big mistake there. Never changed the name. He's got to take lessons from Joe Goldberg, if you've seen this show, You.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so take notes from him to fake your own death. But authorities were able to track him down, and he was sentenced to 89 years in jail because that's how long it took the authorities to find him. He was told to pay about $30,000 in damages and just, you know, sending people on searches for him. In all the trouble, obviously. There's no specific crime for faking your own death in Wisconsin, so the judge came up with 89 days. But I believe this is way too short.
Oh, you get sentenced for faking it?
Yeah, that's illegal. You can't fake your own death?
It's considered fraud.
Yeah, because you're sending all these people on searches for you. You got the authorities working. I mean, it's not like he's, you know, they said that in this article, you know, there's not a specific time of like, you know, you got to serve for 6 months or a year or something. Huh. But, you know, they had to make up a time and they came up with 89 days in prison. And now he's probably single and hopefully rotten.
The most wild thing about all that is he takes all these measures and then it's, oh, and he reversed his vasectomy. Why?
Yeah. Like, you want to have kids with a new girl.
I guess, but I mean, like, goodness, all the other steps you're making seem like you're trying to run away from domestic life.
And then it's easier to get tracked down once you have kids.
Once you have kids.
Birth certificates.
DNA.
Going to school.
Like, I get it if you're trying to fake your own debt to get out of, like, paying creditors, child support, whatever. If you're just trying to fake your own death, just, you know, whatever. I don't know. That's 89 days in jail worth.
PP in the morning every Tuesday at this time. The show of whales takes over. Kyle Brandt, NFL Network at 9:20. Tommy Yarish, DallasCowboys.com at 9. And next, Jeremy Fowler, who just dropped the big piece on ESPN with Don Van Natta on how the Cowboys divorce actually happened. Who else was involved? Jeremy Fowler, ESPN NFL Insider, next. Jeremy Fowler is the only one this entire time that I saw mention possible teams interested in Micah Parsons and working a deal out with the Cowboys. Well, this morning, Jeremy Fowler, ESPN NFL reporter, along with a friend of the show, Don Van Natta, dropped the big article inside the Cowboys' decision to trade Micah Parsons. And Jeremy is joining us on the Home of the Cowboys with Sean and RJ right now on the D&M Leasing Hotline on 105.3 The Fan. Good morning, Jeremy. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for having me.
What was the breaking point in all of this, in your opinion?
So it sounds like the breaking point was March 18th, where we were able to detail what Cowboys sources claimed was a negotiation directly with Micah Parsons, driven by Parsons. They feel like, you know, Micah initiated talks. You know, the Parsons camp vehemently disagrees with that. But it just, there was no recovery from that day where Jerry locked in on believing that, hey, we have a deal with Micah and it's a take it or leave it situation. You know, where agent David Mulugeta was like, if that's the case, then we don't have a deal. And from there, it just, and of course, Jerry had his interpretation of how he thinks those words went. And so from there, there was really no negotiation from that point on. There was no exchanging of proposals. Wow. It was quiet. And so, you know, Dallas really just by mid-August, had kind of started to move on.
Jeremy, you know a lot of agents. You've been doing this for a long time. How unusual was Jerry's approach here? Of not only negotiating with Micah to the degree that he did, but also just not communicating with Mulugeta. How does this happen a little bit more often, like, than we think, or this stands alone?
Well, a lot of agents I've actually talked to in the last few months, particularly about this Micah Parsons situation, do say that it's a hurdle sometimes with certain teams that try to go directly to the player. But Dallas is the most frequently known offender of that. You know, it's called hot boxing, which you mentioned in the story. The team tries to get you in a box, kind of sink their teeth into the player, mm-hmm. and then they can just cling to that, and it sort of puts the agent in a precarious spot. And, you know, it's one of those things where I think with high-profile players, with a team like Dallas moving forward, you probably have to warn your player, like, hey, this is what they're going to do, you know, if you want to warn them of that. So, but that's the thing with Dallas, I think, at least from their interpretation, this is just what they claim, but they feel like Micah's the one who made the phone call March 18th, came into the office, was almost dictating terms. That's how they painted it. So because of that, I think Jerry Jones feels either he was duped or, you know, he feels like Micah went back on his word. and they just never recovered from that point.
I know you said that there were no negotiations or formal proposals between the two sides, but tell us about a final attempt from Micah's side to approach Dallas before traded.
Yeah, it was my understanding from sources that on Tuesday, David Mulugeta, the agent for Micah Parsons, reached out directly to the Joneses in an email just saying, like, something to, as it was recalled to me, something to the effect of, like, hey, we're, you know, there's been a lot said in the media, probably some miscommunication out there, but despite all of that, we know he would have a robust trade market, but, you know, we're willing to do a deal. Maybe we can hammer something out. Maybe we can get together. It was basically an olive branch, like a last-ditch effort. And Jerry Jones said something to the effect of, well, you know, we've moved on and we're looking at trading him, so it's either he goes somewhere in a trade or we're back to where we were, which pretty much means he's, it was interpreted as he would have to play on the fifth-year option. And, you know, at that point, the ball got rolling pretty quickly. Green Bay got a formal offer to Micah Parsons later that Tuesday. So at some point, everything went down that day, and then they had a couple days to negotiate a contract, which I think was pretty smooth because, you know, Mulugeta has Jordan Love and Xavier McKinney, a lot of star Packers players, so there was already a built-in respect there. So it was far easier to do than this Dallas deal was with Parsons over the last 5 months.
Jeremy Fowler, ESPN, with the headlining piece on the website, along with Don Van Natta, inside the Cowboys' decision to trade Micah. Jeremy, what were some of the concerns that you learned throughout the homework for this piece that, that Dallas had with Parsons? What were some of the things that, that concerned them about him?
You mean as a player?
Yeah.
Inside the locker room?
Yeah.
In the building?
All the issues, so, from the podcast to the work ethic, all of it.
Yeah, I would say nothing out of the ordinary for a star player. It wasn't a situation where he was out partying or missing meetings. I think he was a hard worker and generally a good teammate. You know, talking to people with the team and either coached Micah recently or have been there, they did feel like the podcast rankled some teammates. You heard Malik Hooker, I believe, spoke out on it at one point.
Yeah.
He wasn't the only one that I think had a problem with it, which is the image of, like, hey, we're studying game film and you're doing a podcast, you know. But players can do things on their own time. I know the front office and the coaching staff didn't have a problem with it, but I think some teammates did. And then, you know, it's just some people I talked to for the story said that, you know, he can be a little critical. Some of that's, you know, of teammates. Some of that can be a passion of the game type thing where he wants guys to step up. But coaches have told him before, like, hey, you're the most talented guy on the team. Not everybody's going to be able to reach that level. So you need to show some grace and lead and bring players along with you as opposed to criticizing them. So those are just some small things. You know, like the stuff about the run defense. I mean, did he play outside of structure sometimes? Yes. But a lot of star pass rushers do that.
Right.
And you pay them to do that to get sacks. So that's not really a huge issue.
Jeremy, you know, you mentioned that, that it was that March 18th meeting that, that really flipped things for Jerry and kind of set everything in motion. Looking back on all these criticisms that they now have and different things like that, do you think that's at all a case of revisionist history at all or building a case since March 18th? Or was there any sort of a push before that date from others in the organization of like, hey, we really should take a look at if we want to pay this guy?
Well, the sides did meet at the combine. You know, there's a situation where all the agents are there in Indianapolis in the hallways of hotel rooms. And, you know, the Cowboys have their bus in Indianapolis. So they, Mulugeta and the Joneses met at some point in Dallas, or if it wasn't the Joneses, it was the Cowboys brass. And for, you know, people we talked to seemed to come away from the combine thinking that Parsons was comfortable going last in the pass rush market, meaning like T.J. Watt, Miles Garrett, Max Crosby, letting some of those deals get done and then coming and batting cleanup with a bigger number. I talked to somebody on the player side who disputed that, that they were open to doing a deal whenever, as long as it was fair and manageable. So they talked at the combine, and then Parsons was in Abu Dhabi, I believe, in a like kind of a vacation march with some other NFL players. When he got back is when everything went down with Dallas. It was that March 18th day. And you have differing accounts as to how that went down. Dallas says that Micah called them eager to do a contract. You know, people on Parsons' side said, no, that's not true. He was getting called from Jerry about a leadership meeting, and then it steered toward contract talks. So either way, regardless, you know, however it got to talking about a contract, it did, it was discussed, you know, and Mike at that point did call his agent, got his agent involved. Jerry called the agent, and then nothing went well from there because it was just, nothing was happening. I mean, at that point, there was a fundamental disagreement, and for 4 months, you had nothing. And then the trade request. So it just, it all seemed so silly because it was avoidable. And for whatever reason, Jerry Jones dug in on the agent part of it, where typically that's something you can work around.
Jeremy, what's the Cowboys' explanation for not dealing him before the draft?
Yeah, so I actually asked some sources specifically about that, and I was told that, A, Dallas was not in the mode of trading Micah Parsons then. Like, they knew that the March meeting didn't go well, but they let it simmer, and they still thought they could revisit it at some point. Like, they weren't thinking pre-draft, like, Parsons is going to be gone.
Yeah.
I don't get the sense that they truly thought that until August, where, you know, one source told us that, hey, Jerry Jones might have said that trading Micah was BS publicly, but he had to kind of zig and zag there, because if you say publicly we're not trading a guy, it probably helps your leverage a little more than when you say you are trading him.
Jeremy, do you think this was a fair offer they got in return?
I actually don't think it was that bad. I mean, it's not ideal. I would say the pulse around the league is mixed reviews, kind of like if you look at a movie that's just okay, the reviews are mixed. That's how I compare it. You know, some didn't have a problem with it. They said that's probably the best you could do. It is a sliding scale with the money the new team has to pay these pass rushers. I mean, people compare the Khalil Mack trade. That was 7 years ago, I believe. His deal was like low 20s per year, like 22, 23 million a year. Mike is now at 47, so that's double the market. So a team's not going to give you 4 first-round picks and have to pay that. They're just not going to do it. So some make the argument that, hey, 2 first and Kenny Clark is actually not terrible. Others say you should have gotten more, and if you would have done it pre-draft, you could have opened things up to more teams. Dallas actually counters that. They believe fundamentally that it's better to wait after the draft to do a trade. That's just kind of their MO. Other teams disagree with that. They think it's better around draft time, but Dallas thinks, like, if you try to do a trade April 24th, teams are eager to make their picks. They don't want to give them away.
Were there other teams involved? Which other teams did they reach out to?
Yeah, we never got the full list. I know the Carolina Panthers inquired. They did not make a formal offer, but they did inquire, so they were in talks. And, you know, we heard some whispers from league circles that Micah had interest in certain teams. Green Bay was one, but, like, a little bit of Baltimore, a little bit of Kansas City, Philadelphia. But we never really – some of those teams didn't look into it, really. I know Kansas City didn't. There wasn't a lot of momentum in some of those other teams. But Carolina did look into it, and – Dallas would have had reason to look into that because of Derrick Brown, you know, star defensive tackle. They were looking for those type of players, those interior D linemen. So that made some sense. But Carolina ultimately didn't want to move Brown and didn't move on that.
Jeremy, what was your other, like, big wow moment in putting this together with Don, where you're like, oh, that's something that people are going to be surprised to read or hear? Was there something else that was a wow moment in here for you?
I would say just some of the commentary out of Dallas about that March 18th meeting, that we were kind of able to nail down the date and the contents of it, and just how it's tough, right? Because they're painting Micah as coming in there and driving the negotiation, initiating it, which Parsons camp disputes. But people in Dallas have a lot of details about all of that, where to the point where if they were making that up, it would be pretty elaborate, you know? So just the sheer conviction that they have that Micah did this, and I would say the guarantees in the contract north of $150 million, I thought was pretty significant. We're able to nail down that number, and, you know, that would have put him in pretty elite air. Now, that was on a 5-year deal. That was kind of the problem versus a 4-year deal that Micah got in Green Bay that will help his earning power over time because he's under contract for less time. And then just the, you know, some of the contents of the email they sent Jerry Jones, that he basically, from my understanding, just replied all and said, no thanks. You know, I thought that was interesting because there was, you know, they had moved on at that point. Did Parsons' camp kind of know they had moved on, and that's why they emailed that day? I don't know that, but I did kind of wonder and meant to kind of get to that in the reporting. Like, why did they email him on that Tuesday? When the, I think it was partly because the whispers of Green Bay and some of the trade stuff had kind of surfaced online a little bit at that point.
Hey, so, man.
It was out there, and it's like, well, hey, let's address this.
Jeremy, fantastic work. Thank you so much for joining us on short notice. Keep killing it on ESPN. We appreciate you.
Hey, thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Jeremy Fowler, ESPN NFL reporter on the D&M Leasing Hotline. Let's talk about Deron Bland getting his extension. Is Trayvon Diggs playing against Philly? And let's find out more about Kenny Clark, who spoke to the media over the weekend. We do it with Tommy Yarsh, DallasCowboys.com, next.